Well, good morning. The E12 Finance and Policy Division will come to order. This morning, we have a treat for us. Dr. Angie Eilers is going to be presenting from Growth and Justice. And I will let Dr. Eilers introduce herself and tell a little bit about why she's here. But I think you'll all enjoy her presentation. And, of course, we all know that this is a tough budget year, and so we will hear from Dr. Eilers with that in mind. But we also know that even in tough times, we have to make the very smartest decisions. And so I appreciate the title of this presentation, Smart Investments in Minnesota Students.
So. Thank you, Senator. Madam Chair, substitute, is that the title? Madam Chair today. Thank you for the invitation. I'm privileged to be before you, and I'm also pleased that I've had a chance to meet most of you one-on-one, and if I haven't, I look forward to that. A little bit of background. Growth and Justice is a progressive economic think tank. We believe that economic growth and economic justice can exist simultaneously. And my background, just by way of record, is I've been conducting educational evaluation and research for 20 years. I've paid particular attention to urban and rural poverty and the intersection that urban and rural poverty have with academic and educational opportunity. This, however, is an economics of education approach. It intersects, of course, with sociology and demographics and a variety of other factors that are at play, but our economic situation is certainly the feature of the day. So this proposal is really framed around an effectiveness and efficiency framework. I'll get to that in a moment. We started out the question about how to best invest in Minnesota students, knowing that education is a chief driver to our economy, by looking forward. And planning in a forward direction is generally one of the best approaches to investing. So we set out by looking toward the year 2020 with the intended strategic goal of increasing by 50% the rate of students who finish some form of a post-secondary degree, either a one-year or a two-year or a four-year degree by the year 2020, with particular attention to our students of color and Native American students who have not historically been attaining post-secondary degrees at the rate that white students have. And this is the picture of where we are today and where we will be if we do nothing. The Minnesota Measures Report, which is put out by the Office of Higher Ed, the last reporting of data is 2006. But as of 2006, Minnesota has a combined rate of students in the age cohort of 24 to 35 that hold a BA or an AA, a two-year or four-year degree, at a rate of 52%. So about one in two students in the age cohort right out of college and in their starting years of work have either a bachelor's or an associate's degree. If we do nothing, our state's demographer projects that combined rate of two-year and four-year degree will shrink back to about 38%. So only one in four students will hold a bachelor's degree, and about 13% will have an associate's degree. And that is moving absolutely in the wrong direction as we consider the more globalized and competitive economy that our students are facing. So again, these are a combination of state demographers' data and the Office of Higher Ed data. If we do nothing, we're moving backwards in the rate of attainment. We're arguing that we should be moving forward from 52% to something more like 75%. A 50% increase of the 52% would put us at about 75%, where three out of four students will have an advanced degree. And the economic argument for that is that the Minnesota economy is such that a student can no longer make a living wage with just a high school diploma. They're going to have to get something beyond high school. Even a one-year degree, some sort of apprenticeship or a professional certificate, will make the difference between a living wage and a non-living wage. The cost of living in Minnesota now is that such that if two working parents with two children make $44,000 a year combined, they are just at the basic needs budget, meaning they have just enough money for housing, one car, no savings, no movie date money, just a basic needs, no frill budget costs $44,000 a year. And that would mean that they'd each be making about $13 an hour. Well, a high school diploma or less will not earn that wage. So we're aggressively advancing the fact that at least three out of four students should have a one-year or a two-year degree at a minimum to make something beyond $40,000 to $44,000 a year. And the reason why the demographer projects that we may shrink backwards in our attainment rate is because of the shifting population. Minnesota has, again, historically seen post-secondary attainment in our white population and our middle to upper income. I could produce a similar slide here on socioeconomic status, but I think the racial story says a lot. The white population, which is the ethnicity or race that has been making the attainment gains, is only predicted to grow by 7% by the year 2030. And you can see the exponential growth of other populations in our state. I don't see this as a challenge or a problem. I see this as an opportunity. We can do very well by these students, not unlike what Minnesota did for its students in 1970. We invested very substantially and very heavily in our Minnesota students in 1970, and we saw an explosive growth in educational performance outcomes as well as economic growth. Our per capita income shot above the national average. Another way to look at the post-secondary rate projections is that for every 100 Hispanic students who get a two-year or a four-year degree today, we're going to need another 243 to 275 for a total of 343 to 375 to get a post-secondary degree by the year 2020. Or for every 100 African-American students, we're going to need another 150 for a total of 250 African-American students to get a post-secondary degree by the year 2020. So, how to map out this challenge? Yes.
Excuse me, Dr. Eilers. Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Excuse me for interrupting you, Dr. Mm-hmm. Eilers. Would you go back to that
yes.
slide again? I think you went by the numbers pretty fast for me.
I'm sorry, this
the
one?
Next one. This one.
Okay.
Tell me again how these numbers are changing.
If we are to reach that 50% increase mm-hmm. from today by the year 2020, we're going to need to see a 275% increase or a total of 300, I'm just going to put it in numeric terms instead of percentages. For every 100 Hispanic students that we have today, we will need to see 275 more for a total of 375, which would correlate with their rate of population growth relative to that post-secondary attainment rate.
Thank you. I get it now.
All right. Any other questions? It is a matter of disaggregating our race and ethnicity numbers. This question was raised a year and a half ago by our very astute steering committee members, and I want to mention the fact that this project was guided by 25 statewide stakeholders in rural and urban settings across the race and ethnicity spectrum, from early childhood, K-12, and higher ed. Business community members were on the committee. At any rate, it was one of the committee members that pointed out that if we only talked about increasing the post-secondary attainment rate by 50%, we could reach that if we only continued to educate our white students at the rate that we have historically. But we have a very different demographic population shift happening.
Dr. Eilers, I think it's worth mentioning also that we in this committee are going to be hearing next week about integration aid, and then we're going to be looking in the working group at the direction we want to go with regard to integration. And as we think about integration and we see these demographic trends, that ought to really have us look at it in a very different way.
Yes. I think this is really the story of our population shift. And this is from our state's demographer, Tom Gillespie. I'm happy to provide this slide for you on PowerPoint if you want to use it and keep it. But I think this is really what needs to be understood as by way of context and by way of planning. And most importantly, because Minnesota has a significant achievement gap. I think it's considered the worst in the country. And that gap will persist unless we very specifically and intentionally direct our efforts and our best practices towards students who have not historically benefited from our public system.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so 2 years ago, I think some of you know, I started on this journey about where to best invest in Minnesota students. And taking on this complex puzzle meant breaking it into small component parts. On the far right of this continuum is the strategic goal we hope to meet, which is increasing the post-secondary attainment rate. But in order to meet that, it's important to map backwards and understand every cohort along the pathway and how they're doing and what needs to happen for them in order to meet that post-secondary attainment goal. It means that students, of course, have to finish high school and qualify to enroll in post-secondary. And the benchmarks highlighted in blue reflect the No Child Left Behind Act and have now been adopted in state statute, which is that all high schoolers by the year 2013 will have to take and pass rigorous coursework in the form of Algebra 2, chemistry, physics, and other advanced sciences. By 2013, today's first graders will have to take and pass Algebra 1 in the eighth grade. Today's three-year-olds will have to, by the year 2013, be reading at or above the third grade level. And while being ready for kindergarten is not a statutory requirement, I think we all recognize both cognitively and conventional wisdom that the more ready a child is for kindergarten, the more likely they are to be reading at the third grade. These are benchmarks that reflect both what we know in the research about cognitive and social development, and now because it's in statute, it's given us more, there's more incentive to reach these goals. So then the next question to ask is, okay, so where are our students currently on each of these outcomes? How many of our students are ready for K? How many of our students are reading at the third grade level? How many are either taking or are likely to take and pass eighth grade algebra, et cetera? So knowing where that is, and I have quite an ugly bar graph detailing that nobody likes, but I'm happy to share it with you later. The next question to ask is, knowing what percentage of students are not at that benchmark, what are the effective interventions that are going to move them from off track to on track? And then ideally, what is the most cost-effective way to do that? And that's what the body of the rest of this presentation is going to address. So just a quick snapshot of where our students are in some of these measures. Using the NAEP data, and by the way, I use NAEP for a couple of reasons. The National Assessment of Educational Progress is considered a more rigorous assessment. It measures more with more accuracy, proficiency in math and reading that's going to correlate with a student's likelihood of surviving more rigorous coursework in high school. It's also more stable as a measure, whereas our state's MCA has been unstable or inconsistent. It's only been in place for a few years. It's tied to our standards, which have been in various forms of development. So other national scholars and other national think tanks also rely on the National Assessment of Education Progress. So this is a picture of where our students are not, where they're off track, the number of percent of students who are not reading at a proficiency level in the fourth and eighth grade. And you can see that these are very troubling numbers. These are very high percentages of students who, if reading does not improve at this, from where they're at the fourth grade level, they are not likely to survive the more rigorous coursework in high school.
Dr. Ellers, could you just tell us what the various colors mean? Because we can't see that.
Not
and
great
it's
color
not
choice.
In our.
On the highest bar are our African American students in an orange color. In blue are Latino Hispanic students at about 85% who are not reading proficiency level. The light orange are the American Indian Alaska Native students who at 80% are below the proficiency level. The green are Asian Pacific Islanders, about 70% are not at the reading proficiency level, and just below 60% are our white students. Now, again, this is a high standard. The NAEP holds reading and math at a high standard, but it's because it's correlated with later success. And by way of explanation, our math scores, unfortunately, are not that much better. These are fourth and eighth grade math scores. More than a little over 80% of our African-American students in the fourth grade are not at the math proficiency level. Just shy of 80% are our Latino students. American Indian Alaska Natives hover just slightly above 70%. Asian Pacific Islanders are doing a bit better at about 58%, and about 42% of our white students are not proficient. Now, what's interesting about this is you'll see that our graduation rates look better. So the question is, how is it that there are fewer students who are...
Dr. Eilers,
yes.
We recently had a presentation on the TIMS results, and this seems a little bit to be inconsistent with what we heard. Do you have any comments on that?
Yes, I serve on the SciMath Minnesota board that commissioned the TIMS study, and I've had a look at the disaggregated data. When we speak in averages, when we speak in the aggregate, some of these disaggregated numbers are masked, And what the TIMS study reported was the aggregate number. I've seen the disaggregated numbers on the TIMS, and it's as troubling.
Senator Saltzman.
Yes. And on that point, I believe that when I think Dr. Schmitz was here, he did talk about the achievement gap. He did point out that what was very disturbing with that was the fact that students of color were not performing, and he did talk about Minnesota having that achievement gap. I don't remember exactly, but that was something that he discussed.
Yep. He was in town last week, and these numbers were presented at St. Kate's, and free and reduced lunch numbers mirror this in many ways. Either way you look at it, through the lens of socioeconomic status or race ethnicity, the numbers are troubling. So I encourage all members to ask for disaggregated numbers as often as possible. It's a point of comfort, really, to rely on sort of our overall averages, but we repeatedly have been, it's been pointed out to us, the achievement gap, and this, in fact, reflects the achievement gap. The other thing that this represents is you can see that there are fewer who are not graduating, even though their proficiency levels are almost twice that. And what that means is that our graduation requirements are not perhaps as rigorous as our testing requirements. And then we're also seeing this gap in the post-secondary enrollment. The graduation requirements are not aligned with the post-secondary enrollment requirements. Minnesota has a 34% remediation rate. That means that one in three students who go on for a two-year or four-year degree are spending an additional year being remediated. And that's an expense to the system, to be sure. I can't recall what the numbers are, but it's tens of millions of dollars that we're spending on remediation. But it's also an expense to the student who is spending an additional year of tuition money, which we know is historically very high right now. So for a two-year degree, a student is in school for 3 years. And for a four-year degree, a student is in school for 5 years. That's real money, a whole year of tuition. It's also an economic opportunity cost that's been lost.
And it seems as though the biggest differential when you look at the did not graduate is in the white students. They may not be proficient, but we are graduating them.
That's right.
Thank you.
So there's some work to be done there. I know the P16 Council has that as one of their priority areas, is to align the graduation requirements with the enrollment requirements, and that alignment would be a really important thing, both economically for the system, academically, and economically for the student. So the question is, knowing where our students are or are not on these key benchmarks, knowing the high number of kids, and we're talking about tens of thousands of kids, sadly, who are not at the key benchmark levels, what are the most effective interventions at those points in the pipeline that will move them to be on track, and at what cost? And just a quick word on method. 2 years ago, I began the review of the literature along this pathway, from early childhood literature to post-secondary literature. What are the most promising and effective practices that have been through the filter of a strict screen, showing a decent effect size conducted over a long period of time, a longitudinal study with a large sample size, replicated in many settings, scaled up across the nation? That's a rather strict filter, but I think it's an important one. Sometimes we rely on case studies or anecdotal evidence, and I think it's very critical that if we're expending our very last dollar, our very scarce dollars, we should be very convinced that what we're spending our money on is something that we can stand with confidence, knowing it's going to have its intended effect. And then you can imagine how much literature there is in education from birth to college. But at about that time, I raised several dollars from our very generous philanthropic community to hire 7 economists to help run this work through yet another additional strict filter. And these scholars came from around the country. I know many of you met them or heard from them in November of 2007 at our education summit. But the other strict filter that we ran this through is, what are the most cost-effective interventions? And through those two filters came a couple of handfuls of effective and cost-effective interventions. Ideally, of course, we would have liked to have seen dozens and dozens of options, but I don't think the educational research is quite there yet. So this is a shout-out for anybody who's interested in conducting more evaluative studies in education or doing the economics of educational investments. I highly encourage that work be done either at the university or funded by the state to support the state agencies to do this research. But this is where our results lie, on a 2x2 matrix from low effect to high effect and low. I just created this little chart this morning. It's supposed to say low cost to high cost. We want to be in the high evidence and the effectiveness. We want to be in the quadrant where we get the most effect for the in the most efficient way. It's supposed to say efficient. But at any rate, we want to be in the quadrant where we get the best bang for the buck. And fortunately, we have locally a lot of talented scholars in at the University of Minnesota and a variety of other institutions who have been conducting research that supports similar findings of ours. But we've broken down, again, this pathway, these benchmarks, to the key periods from pre-K, birth to K, really, K to 3, 4 through 12, then transition into higher education. In the early childhood years, Our research found that some of the effective programs include a birth to three home visiting program. This is slightly different than what we currently have in place, which is the Early Childhood and Family Education Program. I highly endorse early childhood and family education, although, again, it could use some more supportive research. But there are many, many families, low-income or high-risk families, who are not accessing the early childhood and family education. As you know, the structure of ECFE is that the participating parents show up to a location at a scheduled time, and they receive the full benefits of ECFE. For those families who are not able or are not showing up for that program, the nurse home visiting program goes out to the family, into their home setting. This could be a public health nurse or a social worker. The benefit in the practice of this is a number of things. It is a check on the overall health and wellness of the mother and the child. To check the environment for signs of abuse, physical or drug or alcohol abuse. But it's also an opportunity for the nurse or social worker to mentor parenting on basic practices, reading to your child, building a bond with the child, as well as mentoring around well baby checkups and all sorts of other early childhood public health interventions that we know pay off. Now, keep in mind, these are not education dollars. This is not necessarily an educational expenditure. This is health and human services expenditure. And additionally, we'd like to see in the early childhood years expansion of quality child care, meaning licensed or certified child care providers, with a learning component up until about the four-year-old age at, I think, a bargain basement price of about $35 million. This is the nurse home visiting program that has been scaled up around the country, is considered highly effective, highly cost-effective at $6 return for every dollar invested. It's now being piloted in Minnesota in a variety of settings.
Excuse me just one moment. Dr. Allers is kind of jumping around in your presentation, and so I see people kind of rumbling through. So it probably just makes sense to just stay focused on what we see on the screen.
I was warned about that.
Yep. And the other thing, Dr. Allers, I wanted to mention is you're talking about the nurse home visiting program, but we do have programs in our community right now that are more education-based. I know there's a program the Jewish Family and Children's Services organization does called the Parent Home Program that has gotten significant results, and those are not medical providers going into the home, and it has more of an education component.
I'm really pleased to hear that, Senator. And let me also say, by way of explanation, that these are illustrations. I'm not by any means endorsing only a few things. As a researcher, what I would say is that any program that has the combined components of an effective program, no matter what the name of it is what we're looking for. And it's a matter of keeping all those components bundled together where you get the intended effect. So the kinds of qualities that I reflected, you know, visiting the home, checking on abuse and neglect, mentoring, that sort of thing. Any program that has those sort of components with some sort of licensed certified provider is ideal. And I'm glad to hear that there are things in Minnesota. And as much as possible, programs that you know of that you find promising, if you can get the University of Minnesota or the Wilder Research or someone to do a short-term effects study, I think it bolsters their long-term survivability. I think more and more our decision-making bodies are going to ask for evidence in order to continue supporting. And I'm always pleased to hear about effective programs.
And in fact, this particular program does have those studies, and they have the data to, they've been doing it for quite some time, so I'll make sure you get that information.
Great. I would love to get that. And any other programs that people know about, I'd love to hear about. And I apologize for modifying the presentation. At the next gateway that a student's on a student's pathway to higher education is really, as I know all of you recognize, is the pre-third grade period of time. Ideally, the research shows that starting at 4-year-old preschool to the age of 8 or the third grade, and a comprehensive programming that represents the following qualities, where there's intensive instructional focus on reading and language acquisition skills, some mathematic reasoning skills, combined with smaller class sizes. Now, I know that's a controversial matter. Class size reduction has had its bumpy history. Part of it is that I don't think it was completely fully understood what the structural change of class size reduction means. But what the research is increasingly finding is that it matters the most in preschool up till the third grade. It starts to lose its intended effect after the third grade. From fourth grade on, a 15-to-1 student-to-teacher ratio doesn't have as much effect as it does in these early years. But again, class size reduction alone won't do it. It's not a magic formula to simply reduce class sizes. It's a matter of having a quality instructor in place with a quality curriculum, plus a family or a home and school relationship. So the research out of Chicago that our own University of Minnesota professor Arthur Reynolds has been conducting for many, many years has shown that it's these sorts of combined and comprehensive services that have continuity over time, where there's a relationship with the parent, the child, and the teacher or the school faculty for the 3- and 4-year period, beginning with a half a day of 4-year-old preschool, with a consistency of exposure to linguistic skills, consistent exposure to social norms and expectations of how to behave and attend school. Over time, that 3- or 4-year period has had a 30% increase in the number of students who will be reading at a high comprehension level by the end of third grade. In other words, for those control groups where this comprehensive continuous programming did not happen, 30% of students were not reading at third grade. Minnesota would do well to have 30% more students reading at the third grade level by the end of third grade, which would cut our lack of proficiency levels in half. And I went through the figures in Minnesota. We have about 36,000 students who would benefit from this sort of comprehensive intervention. And I think all of you also know that if not reading at the third grade level, they are most likely going to be labeled special ed starting in the fourth grade, and that drives the cost of educating that student up by 4 times. So while $285 million looks like a large investment from 4-year-olds to 8-year-olds, the $1 billion that we would be spending on these 36,000 students to remediate them, have them playing catch-up over the rest of their K-12 years, is an expense I don't think we can afford. So it is just another way of reinforcing that these early dollars spent well, spent effectively, will pay off in the long run. And the Child Parent Centers out of Chicago are one example. Other examples are things like Success for All, Roots and Wings, Reading Recovery, Read 180. There are a number of programmings that have this intensive instructional focus on reading acquisition skills, but importantly, coupled with a family or a home relationship and a teacher-student ratio that is manageable. An incredible benefit-cost ratio, 10-to-1, is probably the highest that we've seen. In the post-third grade period, and we call that whole period, by the way, from birth to third grade or birth to 8 years old, the ready to launch. Once a child is sort of reading at the third grade level, we can say with confidence they are well through their early childhood years and well on their way to more academic learning. So we support the notion of more rigorous coursework, even as early as the fourth grade. And there are many, many impressive case studies that have shown that students from all socioeconomic, racial, geographic backgrounds can achieve at high levels when we hold them to high expectations and expose them to rigorous coursework. What many students who come from a disadvantaged background often do not benefit from are a number of social supports to keep them on track in this academic or rigorous programming. So a lot of the research during these years, in the middle school and high school years, are calling for small learning communities or and again, it's not about teacher-student ratio, rather just adult-to-child relationships. So seeing more counselors in the school, for example, paraprofessionals, mentors, and tutors for these students so that there are more adults in a child's life that are keeping them on track academically and socially seems to show the intended effect. So we can call for higher academic rigor, but the important part for our students in the achievement gap is to provide the social support that keeps them on track. Some of these programs are things like AVID, which I know the District of St. Paul has adopted district-wide, and I endorse that choice. I was also pleased to see that of the effective interventions, an ethnically specific intervention bubbled up, and I'd like to share that with Senator Torres Ray when I get an opportunity. But what's particularly important and why I'm pleased to see this, as you know, our Hispanic population is the fastest growing subpopulation in the state of Minnesota. And it's also beginning to outpace African-American students in terms of high school dropouts. So the Achievement for Latinos Through Academic Success is an intervention that builds a relationship with the student and the parent and the teacher. It's a kind of a counseling or a mentoring program that can happen either in school or out of school. And again, it doesn't necessarily have to be education dollars. Some nonprofit organizations have been providing this service. They attend to behavior issues and attendance issues and study skills and that sort of thing. And while it's not as high of a rate of return as some of the other interventions, I think in terms of keeping our Latino students in high school and on track, at a 3-to-1 return is well worth the investment. Another example, and again, these are just illustrations, is the Talent Development High School. Another one that's similar to this is called First Things First. It's a small learning community with an emphasis on academic rigor, but with mentoring relationships between the teachers, the students, parent involvement, some community involvement, money set aside for professional development and training. Again, going through the figures of the number of students in Minnesota who are not performing well in their high school years, we have 160,000 high schoolers from the 9th to 10th grades who are not proficient in math and reading. If we were to provide these sort of small learning community interventions in the 9th through 12th grade years at $56 million, we would be doing ourselves a considerable favor. We have 10,000 high school dropouts every year, and over the course of their lifetime, the cost to Minnesota is $10.6 billion. That calculation is based on the lost earning opportunity of those 10,000 each year. We're talking each year these students drop out. It's a calculation based on the social services and the reliance on the criminal justice system and other social service expenses over the course of a lifetime. So again, $56 million is a small expense to keep these students in high school, finishing high school, and being ready for something beyond high school at nearly a $7 to 1 return. And then finally, as students transition from secondary school to post-secondary school, a number of things need to happen. Avoiding dropout, avoiding teen pregnancy, and at a small cost, $10 million to prevent high school dropout or teen pregnancy, but also providing social supports and financial supports to move them from a publicly funded secondary system to a privately but somewhat subsidized system in higher ed. While $340 million looks considerable, it is a combination of academic, social, and financial supports, and I'll get to that in a moment. One of these, I think, low-cost interventions that helps students transition from secondary to post-secondary, again, is supported by a nonprofit organization. One that's very well-known and is considered very effective, and it's homegrown, is Admission Possible. Came from the mind of a man out of St. Paul. And what this does is identify low-income, promising students, about C average students who are would be first generation college goers, by the way, who didn't necessarily see themselves going on to college. Admission Possible, through the help of AmeriCorps volunteers, identifies these students in the 9th grade, starts working with them in the 10th and 11th grade, mentors and models to them study skills, helps them figure out how to take an ACT test, helps them figure out how to apply to college, fill out those financial aid forms. They even take van loads of students onto college campuses and give them tours. And at a 99% college acceptance rate and an 80% finishing rate, this small investment in these students has gone a long way. These, again, are students who never saw themselves going to college, and the fact that 99% of them are finishing some sort of post-secondary degree is a phenomenal contribution to their individual lives and to our larger economy. And it's these sorts of programs that can happen through nonprofits or through the public school system or even through our community education programs. We have a number of pieces of infrastructure in place. It's really just a matter of aligning academic requirements, social support, and financial assistance to move students through the final gateway onto higher ed.
Dr. Eilers?
Yes.
Excuse me. With Admission Possible, how is that happening right now in our community and where?
Absolutely. It's quite ubiquitous, I think, in St. Paul, and it's beginning to move out into various points around the state, and they've now just set up an office in Milwaukee.
Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Eilers, is the ramp up to readiness that Kent Bickel and the university, is that similar to this Admission Possible?
You know, I as I understand ramp up to readiness, I believe it is a it's a structure, it's a design, and I think there are pieces, little component parts that make up the whole ramp up to readiness. But I'll have to take a closer look at it, so I don't feel entirely qualified to answer that question.
And as you go through your presentation, if there are states or places where there are best practices, where we've seen significant gains using what you are talking about, if you could mention that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Thank you. These are, in fact, illustrations. I have in the report that I think you've all received by now, at page 25, the appendix, are those programs that, again, made it through our two strict filters. They showed an effect over a long period of time with a decent effect size, large sample size, and they've been proven cost-effective. Now, those things under promising interventions either had one or the other. You know, either they were under study, their effect study wasn't either quite complete, or they didn't have a cost analysis associated with it. So you'll see any number of programs in the appendix. And surely every day and hopefully more and more things are coming online in terms of showing effectiveness. I'd also like to point the committee toward the What Works Clearinghouse. The Department of Education developed the What Works Clearinghouse during this past administration. I think it's through the IES, which stands for the Institute for Educational Studies, I believe. So I encourage you to look on the What Works Clearinghouse. They similarly have done a review of those programs that are considered effective, and they've put them on their website.
Dr. Eilers, do they have the same programs listed in the What Works? Is there data mirroring your data?
Yes, the one thing that they haven't asked is about cost effectiveness. So we probably have fewer things on our list because we're looking at what the final cost is.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, it would be important, I would think, for the department to consider costs when we endorse a program in terms of a What Works.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And again, this is another shout-out for anyone who wants to get into the economics of education. It's woefully under-analyzed. There's a lot more that needs to be done. In recent years as well, Professor Henry Levin at Columbia University has launched the Center for Cost-Benefit Studies in Education, another website I encourage committee members to take a look at. I believe it's cbcse.org at Columbia University. And they, too, are trying to put these two pieces together, what works and at what cost.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. But also a caveat here. This research was conducted over a year ago. This report was published in October. It will easily and hopefully become outdated because, ideally, more and more things are coming online. So it's a matter of keeping up with what's out there. So here's the final spreadsheet that we, a year ago argued when we thought that the economy might have allowed us this sort of investment in Minnesota students. This breaks down the various periods, the little gateways of along the pathway of a student's academic career. We tried to put a figure on the kinds of investments we're talking about, and the way these figures were arrived at is that it's the number of students, the thousands of students who are not at their level where they need to be, times the cost of the intervention per student for a cumulative cost for those cohorts of students. And I know this figure is irrelevant at this point, but it happens to tally up to $1 billion. And it isn't actually coincidental. We, as a committee, set a limit for ourselves at $1 billion. At one point, we thought that as we were advancing our fair taxation plan, Growth and Justice, that we thought we could fairly and reasonably raise $1 billion through a fair share taxation plan. We believe that there's an appetite in Minnesota to be able to pay for the things that they know work for our students. So we capped it at $1 billion. There are more programs. There are other interventions that would exceed the billion-dollar figure that we have here, and I'm very pleased to share that with the committee. It basically reflects all of these interventions. But now we're in a new situation. We're in a new economy. Last year, I really thought, oh, boy, we'll pass that fair share taxation plan and have that $1 billion, and I have a plan for it. Then the financial floor fell up from beneath our feet, and I thought, okay, well, these are the things not to cut. This is the list of things that we know have an effect and are cost-effective, so by all means, I'd really like to protect them. But then came the rain shower called the federal stimulus plan, and I think that it's a perfect opportunity to plant the seeds today for future harvest. We have a couple of years of opportunity here, federal stimulus dollars, which should not, I don't think, be mistaken for some sort of spending. I think they should be viewed as an opportunity for investment, and I think we can invest very wisely. It will pay off in the long term. And with that, I'd just like to say, if I leave no other impression today, it's that I'd like to suggest that resource allocation decisions be framed around these four principles across the entire education continuum, addressing the whole child, social, academic, and financial issues around a child. I think it's difficult to choose our children, and I'd recommend that we not choose our littles over our biggers. I'd like to see us address the entire education continuum. I'd like our investments to be made comprehensively in scope, in other words, keep interventions whole, and I'd like to encourage that we not pick apart and just pick pieces of an intervention, but keep them whole. That's where the effect comes in. And then address children or students where they're at, where their particular needs are at, painting with a finer paintbrush rather than a wide paintbrush. And then ideally to have these resource allocation decisions made with accountability, where it shows effects and where it shows its cost effectiveness. With that, I'm happy to answer any further questions.
Members, questions, comments? Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Dr. Eilers. It's no secret to folks that I'm interested in strategic planning for education. Can you give us some of the key hallmarks that would help us create a planning process, or how would we know we have a good plan, or is it in the variables of the way the world works? Does a strategic plan make sense? If we developed one, would we have to be constantly reinventing it?
Senator Rummel, I'll answer that by thinking a bit like a business, if you will. A good business always begins with a strategic plan. A good business or an enterprise knows where they want to go and takes their context and their climate into consideration. And I hope I painted a picture of what our demographic context looks like. And then a good strategic plan maps backwards and asks, if that's the future that we want or the outcome that we want, how are we going to get there? And what do we need to know about the landscape in order to get there? And what are the best practices? What are other competitive industries doing so that we can stay ahead? And investing in education is not unlike any strong enterprise. You want to think long term. You want to take into consideration the landscape and the actors, and then scan the environment for best practices, knowing what the costs are and the cost drivers. And I hope that this plan has laid that out. What it requires is more than a single person at a nonprofit organization, however. I think if you had hired the McKinsey consulting firm, you'd probably be out several thousands of dollars. I'm happy to do it for free. But nonetheless, I think the state of Minnesota should be doing this sort of due diligence, this sort of analysis. The state has access to and provides funding for any number of research units across this city and across the state. Ideally, I'd like the state of Minnesota to cohere the number of research units and economic analysts into a buffered institution that is protected from politics, that is protected from the volatile funding cycles, and is considered a clearinghouse of effective programs. And not only in education, but I sympathize with all of you who are part-time legislators and may not have a PhD in education, but nonetheless you are faced with very complex issues. I'd like you to have the ease and access to an institution, a clearinghouse, where you could call up and say, what do I need to know about juvenile justice systems, or what do I need to know about delinquency or pregnancy prevention or early childhood or reading? Reading alone is a field that is intensely complex. And I know we have these at the University of Minnesota and other nonprofit organizations. I'd love to see an institution that bridges research and policymaking and practice and where you have easy access. That would be good long-term strategic institutional development. I don't see it necessarily as another layer of government. I see it as an efficiency move in some parts, in some ways, pulling together the various parts that do exist and creating a standard quality, a high quality, a standard where everybody's, in other words, it's not of uneven quality or question as to whether it's partisan or political. And again, buffered from politics and the volatility of the cycle, the funding cycle.
Senator Rommel.
Thank you again. I appreciate that, Dr. Eilers. The thing that I'm most intrigued about, the plan that you're presenting, this is the, what are we, K-12?
E-12?
Policy and Finance?
E-12.
E-12, all right. Is that your suggestions seem to go beyond the, whether it's E-12 box. I'm just thinking about the child parent centers. So many of the things you mentioned go beyond the strict things that we often think of as the education project. Are you suggesting that our education obligation is a community business policy? This is bigger than just K-12 education or E-12 education, isn't it?
Slightly.
Dr. Eilers.
Excuse me. It's slightly larger than E-12. I think E needs to be defined. I'm not sure if the committee has defined E. I don't know if E means B. I don't know if early means birth or not. But if E means early as in 3 years old, then yes, the birth to 3 years old is not in here. I would hope and assume, and I think that there are collaborative relationships between the Departments of Health and Human Services and the Department of Education where they recognize that good prenatal care and well baby checkups and immunizations are a part of the health and readiness of a child for future learning. But if not, I encourage that sort of relationships where school health nurses and public health nurses or school social workers and public social workers are working together around a child holistically, recognizing that a child is a part of a larger family. And if that family is in the social services system, then linking the child's relationship with the services provided at the school is an important way of knitting together the safety net so that our systems are more efficient and our children and families aren't falling through the system's cracks where they haven't overlapped. So it may require some institutional integration here and there. And ideally, we'd like to see more of a seamless experience for children and families. You know, as they navigate the pre-K world and negotiate their way into the K-12 system, later on they have to cross that threshold again and they have to navigate the secondary system with the post-secondary system. And if your family is not from have the family or past experience of working with these various systems, it can be quite complex, overwhelming, intimidating. The more seamless we make this experience for our children and families, the greater success they're likely to have.
Senator Folby.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And Dr. Eilers, I really appreciate your presentation. I am a current Humphrey Policy Fellow, and I'm looking for a project, so we might need to talk.
Perfect.
I also, my background is social work and sociology, so I really get the whole child perspective and how we, with regard to education, I think we work way too hard to pick it apart to reading, writing, and math, and those students that aren't getting those basic needs or their basic social supports will never get to that other piece. So I just want to highlight that. We're in a tough situation. And I know you don't want to do this, prioritize this list of distribution of investments.
Yeah.
But I'm going to challenge you a little bit. If we comprehensively can't take on the whole thing at once, which ideally would be the right thing and the best thing to do, can you prioritize that at all?
Mm.
Dr. Eilers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have been asked that question before. If I had $1, mm-hmm. where would I put it? This is another way I like to think about all of our children. We are responsible for our 3-year-olds, our third graders, and our 13-year-olds. I would put 40 cents from birth to third grade. I'd put 25 and a half cents in the 4th through 12th grade years, and I'd put 34 cents into the experience when those students transition from post-secondary to post-secondary school. I think the dollar would be well spent in any one of these categories, but I would hate to might want to forsake the opportunities or experience of these other students. On a more practical note, I know that these federal stimulus dollars have some we're talking about several millions of dollars here, and it seems to me that, and I'm no expert on this, and I'll defer to Mr. Nauman and others who have looked at this closely, but it seems that we have some latitude to spend some of these dollars. So the Title I dollars, for example, could be invested very effectively and creatively in ways that we have not been using them before. The Innovation Fund that has come up could, again, be used, I think, effectively and creatively in ways, again, this is our opportunity. This is a short time period to be very alternative and creative and our thinking. Should it come to that level, I'd be happy to collaborate or be a resource to this decision-making body at any point on those ideas.
Thank you. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Eilers, I know you talked a little bit about the quality of instruction. And in thinking about the teachers that are in the classroom and whose role is it? Is it the state's role? Is it the university's role? Is it the schools themselves and getting teachers, the high-quality teachers, or to implement the kind of programs that you're talking about? Are we sitting pretty well in that particular regard, or is there something more that we need to do either at the local level or the state level?
Senator, if I'm not mistaken, I believe I heard Deputy Commissioner Chaz Anderson say yesterday that Minnesota's teacher quality is something at like 97%. I think that's the highest in the nation, and I think Minnesota can be proud of the fact that we have a high-quality cadre of teachers. That's not to say that there is not always room for improvement in every profession and in every industry. There is always room for professional improvement. I think professional development dollars could be spent more effectively. I don't think we have a very good handle on how those professional development seminars are conducted or to what effect and at what cost. I'd love to see a closer examination of professional development. I also think that the early childhood industry, if you will, could benefit from a similarly rigorous training experience. I know that the quality, what's it called, Eric? The
quality rating
system. Thank you, Senator. Is being implemented, and with more licensed and certified, qualified adults in the care of young children from birth to 5 years old would be a terrific advantage for those children's experiences, both their health and academic wellness. And then a third response to your question is that I believe that teacher quality begins upstream. I believe that it happens at the degree-granting institutions. I think that we do need to take closer examination of our degree-granting institutions and our teacher education training programs. The institutions of higher ed have been operating at any rate, it's worthy of examining. And and aligning the teacher quality requirements with the increasingly rigorous academic experiences of the children.
Well, Dr. Eilers, oh, very good. Senator Wieger.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Great report, Dr. Eilers.
Thank you, Senator.
You have an implementation plan. You're going to roll out the report to a lot of different groups, but is there a particular strategy for additional work that you can share with us on this? Then I do have a question.
Yeah, my response is two-part. One is that, you know, we're a think tank, and I'm an ideas person. I'm not always in the implementation business. I'm putting it out there in your good hands and hoping that you can legislate or choose to legislate accordingly where it makes sense. But I'm also speaking to a lot of community groups and districts. And, you know, frankly, I think this framework or this model is more fitting for districts. If, for example, every school board examined where their students are at, from ready for K to ready for college, and took an assessment of where their students are with much more specificity and, identifying their particular students in a more local, at a more local level, we get greater accuracy. And then if they had this sort of menu of innovative interventions to choose from based on where their students are at or are not at, knowing, for example, I know that in northern Minnesota, many of our students are finishing high school, taking the kind of rigorous coursework that readies them for post-secondary school, and yet they're not going. They're not enrolling. Either they think they can't afford it, or they haven't got the they'd be first-generation college goers, and it's not in their family's experience to go on to post-secondary school, or they look at their local economy and think, I'm not sure a post-secondary degree is really necessary in our local economy. It might be with that kind of particularity that we take interventions like Admission Possible or dual enrollment programs or early college high school and scale those up there, knowing that the economy is shifting right now, that there may be a burgeoning industry of wind development and solar technology happening in northern Minnesota. Those students need to be ready for post-secondary school. So you can see that there are different needs in different communities. So I would really love to advance the idea that this be a framework that's used by school boards in their decision-making. They're also making resource allocation decisions with local tax dollars, and I'd like to think that they're making it around what's effective and what's going to meet their students' needs in the most efficient way. So that's my two-pronged reply to your question, which is take from this what you will. I'd be happy to work with you in modifying it where it fits more practically with the budget and the stimulus dollars or the various categorical aid programs. But then I'd encourage your local school boards to also make decisions accordingly with facts and evidence in hand and with dollar figures.
Dr. Eilers, you have talked about the importance of investing in post-secondary, and we have seen studies that have shown that if we increase the graduation rate, that for each student who graduates that we didn't expect to graduate, there's an overall savings of $127,000 over time. What have you seen in terms of the investment in post-secondary, and can you differentiate post-secondary in terms of the trade programs versus the four-year college? One of the things we talk about as a committee is the importance of making sure all kids have some kind of opportunity, but, you know, is it important that it's four-year college?
Mm-hmm. No, I would argue that it is a one or a two or a four-year degree. And, you know, it's really the next big study that I'd like to work on, which is to work with DEED, for example, and the Office of Higher Education in Minsky, and identify what our growing industries are in our state or future growing industries in our states, which I believe are going to be in the renewable energy technologies, which is going to require science and technology, engineering, and math. And many of them are Minnesota students are very equipped for that. But aligning what those new burgeoning industries are or future industries, high-wage industries that we should be attracting to Minnesota, and aligning our post-secondary system degrees with those new industries. I think our Minsky system is in some ways a sleeping giant. I think we could be maximizing the greater utility of those colleges and universities where they are and aligning the degrees accordingly. So I'd love to see more science, technology, and engineering happening in our northern tier states where we've got a taconite plant that is producing steel. Steel produces wind turbines. Wind turbines produces energy. There's a whole utility industry that's going to be reformed. And there is a study that needs to be done on how we're maximizing our degree-granting institutions, the types of degrees, how we're counseling our students to be ready for those kinds of degrees, letting a ninth grader know that algebra makes sense, understanding a hypotenuse will make sense when they're trying to erect a wind turbine. They need to see that connection. And I think that aligning the secondary and the post-secondary schools with the kinds of industries that we want and should will be seeing in the state is really the next step.
Senator Folby.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And Dr. Eilers, backing up to your last point about school boards, because I was thinking about that earlier in the presentation and looked at your steering committee and your advisory council, and just wanted to know if you've included school boards or the Minnesota School Board Association in on this, or if you'll be presenting to them at some point or have.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Eilers.
Senator, I'll answer your last question first. I have presented at the Minnesota School Board Association, and I regret that the Minnesota School Board Association in some form was not represented in this committee. I had to cap it at 25 because it was growing to be unwieldy. There are many stakeholders, of course, who could and should have been a part of the steering committee, but I have spent a considerable amount of time and effort doing outreach efforts to a variety of professional associations, including the School Board Association and specific school board members and school board leaders and the National School Board Association.
Senator Roepling.
Thank you. I'm sorry, I missed the earlier part of the presentation, and you may have discussed this, but you talk about a half-day preschool program, and I'm wondering how much you looked at wraparound programs or bringing the preschools into the daycares and how that would work for many of our youngest members of society who are in daycares very much of their day.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Eilers.
Senator, it's an excellent question. The reason why the half-day preschool, four-year-old preschool is listed there is, again, as an effective efficiency move. 3 and 4 year old preschool in general would be terrific. What we can really realistically afford would be at a minimum a half day of 4 year old preschool for more and more of our students at a minimum. But to answer your question more completely, I absolutely see the effect and the reasonableness of rolling our 3 and 4 year old childcare and preschool experiences with our K-3 schools. And in fact, if ever there was an opportunity to do that, it's now with school construction dollars. If we can modify our elementary schools, some of which are too big for the number of schools that we have or too old and need to be remodeled, or at any rate, I think it's a perfect opportunity to take advantage of school construction dollars and begin to create more holistic and comprehensive early learning centers that go from as low as, young as 3 years old to the third grade, where we have, again, this very complete set of offerings, where we have continuity and comprehensiveness of services and practices that are targeted for our early learners. It may be reconceptualizing what elementary school is. Maybe it's really about early learning schools, where child's care, and not just education in the form of preschool, but their child care, a public health clinic as well, for example, where immunizations and other things can be offered. All these things are sort of under one roof. And in our very high-risk communities, I can imagine facilities or settings in which there are very comprehensive wraparound services altogether, maybe food shelves, public health clinics, GED training centers, job skills training centers, an online a library of sorts where there is computer access for parents who are looking for job training while their children are in the same building being cared for in a quality child care or preschool setting. At any rate, you can imagine that the word holistic and comprehensive can be as creative as we can get, but there are whole buildings right now that have gone vacant because businesses are closed, and yet they were built on the bus line or they're in communities where urban plight is happening. When businesses start shutting down, criminal elements start moving in, and a way to curb that is to reform or restore, revitalize that empty retail space into a more comprehensive learning and family services space that, again, provides a variety of services and efforts, all built around early learning quality experiences for children and families.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you. So would you suggest that we put the 3- and 4-year-olds on the school bus with the rest of the elementary school students? Or I don't quite track. It sounds like you're talking about having them all in the same program for pretty much the same length of time of the day. I'm not sure I'm ready for that. I just am wondering what your perspective is.
Dr. Eilers.
Senators, I'm not suggesting that it's mandatory or not even necessarily universal, but if the facility and the opportunities are there that families can choose to elect into this sort of set of services, knowing that it's there. Currently, the K-3 settings are constitutionally provided. We have compulsory attendance laws, but I think many families recognize that they're moving around the city, taking one kid to a preschool and another kid to a child care center and another one to a kindergarten, and in some ways a holistic, comprehensive, all one-stop shopping sort of place is at least a structural or a facilities option for families.
Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Much of our preschool programming right now is kind of based on parental choice, and we haven't set up a system in the public schools that you know encourages all children to go to one facility. It's sort of like our higher ed system in a lot of ways, that people can take, if they're qualified for a basic sliding fee, they can take that and use it at a variety of facilities or at home daycares. I guess I am rather a proponent of choice and having families be able to choose where they think the best setting is for their children. Have you thought about, almost a grant or, all right, I'll say it, a scholarship or voucher program
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
for that age?
Mm-hmm. Dr. Eilers.
Senators, it's certainly true. On the bookends of the K-12 system, we have private settings, and families and children benefit according to what they can afford. So if you can afford a lot of a quality experience, you can buy it. And in higher ed, we call it tuition. In pre-K, you know, we just call it expense. It's an expense. What we afford ourselves also tends to stratify us as well. I would love to see the state subsidize our low-income families to be able to afford, to get a tuition subsidy, to be able to afford to attend a quality experience so they can be set on an early road to greater success, because the more they start behind, the longer they'll stay behind. So if we can equalize and level the playing field for all students, we'd be doing all of us and them a terrific service.
Thank you, Senator Hahn, and then Senator Wieger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Eilers, and I apologize, I was also missed a little bit earlier of your presentation, but I had a question about in your outline and discussion about the principles for investment in education.
Mm-hmm.
What about the current investments we're making? How much of what we currently do is consistent with your principles?
Mm-hmm.
Is it all consistent with it? Half? I mean, mm-hmm. Part of my question is if we say this is what we should be doing, and we're spending $7 billion a year today,
mm-hmm.
should we just keep doing what we're doing today or redeploy that? Or what is your principles? How does that apply to what we're currently doing?
Mm-hmm. Senator?
Dr. Eilers.
If I had a twin sister, I would have loved to have conducted a parallel study, a reallocation of existing funds study. But then again, I asked myself, is that the role of a nonprofit organization? I think the state could undertake an examination of what we're currently doing and asking, are we getting, here's a little matrix that I drew earlier, although I mislabeled it, are we, in everything we do, are we in the high effectiveness, high efficiency quadrant? And I think there are many things that we expend money on that cost us millions and tens of millions of dollars every year, and I don't know that we've asked the question, is this tied to academic achievement? Is this advancing student learning? Is this an expenditure that's meeting their academic, social, and financial interests to move them along in the pathway? It's a question. These principles absolutely should apply to current investments.
And Madam Chair?
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Dr. Eilers. And I appreciate that. And that's part of my question, I guess, is because you do call for an additional $1.5 billion or some additional resources to be devoted. And I think, to me, that makes sense if you say the current resources are being used productively. If they're not, I mean, if the goal is to say, well, we have to have another $1 billion of meaningful investment, and we've got $1 billion or $2 billion in the current investment that's not meaningful, then it would seem to me to accomplish that goal would be redeploying, rather than, as you're advocating, to go out and let's increase the tax burden to the economy and bring in new resources. Doesn't that seem to me, well, your comment, is it reasonable to say let's try to do that before we go out and just bring more money into the system? I mean, what's your thought?
Dr. Eilers.
Senators, one reallocation study that I've looked at closely, and I think it bears consideration, is to look at where we spend the most money from the state. And with all due respect, I am an accountability person, obviously. But if I'm not mistaken, we are testing our students in the third grade, and the fourth grade, and the fifth grade, the sixth, the eighth, the ninth, and the tenth at an extreme expense. And those tests are lagging indicators. We find out afterwards what our students didn't learn the year before. When, in fact, a lot of rigorous academic requirement and professional development training effects have shown when there's meaningful assessments that are applied to learning in a timely way that would be directly tied to academic achievement. An example I'm thinking of is the NWEA, which is what half the districts in Minnesota are affording themselves. They're buying that because they know, the principals, the district administrators, and the teachers know that when they test a student in October on fractions and they find out on Thursday that she didn't understand fractions, they're not likely going to start teaching them percentages the next week. They know they have to double back and teach fractions before they move on to percentages. The way we're testing now at great expense is finding out in May that in October she didn't understand fractions or percentages or decimals, and it's too late. And in the fourth grade, the student will have to be remediated and brought up again on fractions and decimals before she can then move on to probabilities. So if we could reallocate some of the ways that we're currently at great expense and continuously testing in a lagging way and use it in more meaningful ways, we'd be having greater effect and efficiency. So I'm wondering, I believe absolutely in testing for learning, and wondering if we couldn't save considerable amount of dollars and it reducing at least in testing every other year. That would be a considerable expense saved, but then reinvested in ways that are meaningful. And if I'm not mistaken, online testing is more effective and efficient. So it's those sorts of examinations that I think bear consideration.
Yes, Senator Wieger, and then Senator Olson.
I was tempted to get into the testing. I know we're going to have a full hearing and hearings on that later, but a very good example on the question posed. I'd like to go back, though, to data collection, early identification, intervention. And we have different silos, as they're called, the groups, organizations, entities that collect information. But we've talked about getting a more comprehensive picture of what problems we have right now. Could you comment more on what we need to do in terms of early identification of problems? We, in the educational context, we talk mostly about early childhood at age three, but you know, I would define it as if a person has an issue at birth, we need intervention. There's approximately 200 births each day in Minnesota. X amount are at risk. Are they identified in the system? And then what is that intervention program going to be? And it's not just education, it's health and social services, human services, and the judicial system has an interest in this as well. And I'm a bit overwhelmed by the various groups, all the money, all the studies that's being done. But if we don't collect data consistently on individuals and then look at the programs that are provided, we're going to continue to be confused, and I would suggest we aren't really serious about getting the best bang for our buck, and surely we aren't going to have students ready for kindergarten.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Dr. Eilers?
Senator, I appreciate where you're going at this. For example, if we start early, Minnesota ranks 27th in the nation with in terms of access to prenatal care. Prenatal care is an early indicator of the health and wellness of that child in the first year of their life. I would love to see the state of Minnesota move into the top 10 on access to prenatal care. It's probably one of the most efficient, cost-effective things we can do for a young child is make sure that that child is healthy and then the mother is healthy early on. From that point on, the kinds of maternal health and child health screenings in the hospital are a measure of the child's wellness. And that data, in collaboration with, again, these larger systems who are attending to children and families, can have a reasonable measure of this child's likeliness of being cognitively disabled or physically disabled, that sort of thing. There are 60,000 students in every cohort. So you said there are 200 born a day. Every year there are 60,000 one-year-olds and 60,000 two-year-olds and 60,000 kindergartners and 60,000 third graders. About a third of them, by the time they enter the K-12 system, qualify for free and reduced lunch. About 25% or one out of four families are at that basic needs budget that I was talking about, which also means that they are economically unstable. These are also the families that are first to lose their job. So economics and socioeconomic status is, unfortunately, tightly linked to later academic success and progress because, again, we can afford ourselves when we have the resources to buy a tutor if Susie's not doing so well or to buy that mad science program in the after-school program or a summer camp that's going to teach them a foreign language. Knowing that 25 to 30% of our students are in the lower socioeconomic category of the 60,000 each year is about 20,000 students, 15 to 20,000 students. So that's just one sort of socioeconomic and demographic indicator. They're, of course, not all at academic risk. I'm a working-class kid from a single-parent family. I went on to get a PhD. It doesn't mean that I'm predetermined to not be a success. But there are enough barriers to their later success. So we have to be attentive to those sorts of numbers. We know that thousands of kids. So should we afford ourselves the kinds of programs and services that are going to wrap around these 15 to 20,000 kids in each cohort in terms of providing them more community ed programs, after-school programs, summer school programs that are going to keep them in social and academic settings that are keeping them stabilized? And then again, in terms of data and collecting data, I think that these new dollars that we're going to see through the stimulus dollars would be a perfect opportunity to develop and bolster more tools. We have a Ready for K assessment in place currently. I think these dollars could be used to strengthen that tool, expand that tool, and develop similar sorts of tools. And when children are 3 and 4 years old or when they're in their first and second grade before they take that very important third grade test, this is a good opportunity to take those dollars and develop tools and assessments that are more accurate and comprehensive and universal so that we can collect data that is, again, predictive of later performance.
Thank you.
Yes, and Senator, just a follow-up. And Dr. Eilers, as you walk the talk of implementation, if you or someone can please be involved in the longitudinal data system that is being developed. Millions of dollars have gone in already. Mm-hmm. A million more are about to come. And I hope it's designed correctly so we don't have all these different silos of programs and all these different data systems. If it isn't integrated and provides some consistent messages for us as policymakers, it's going to continue to be very complex, and students will fall through the crack.
I appreciate that, Senator, and thank you for connecting the dots for me. I will follow up with Ms. Gadara, who is working on this longitudinal study, and we'll align our work together. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Dr. Eilers. I'm not sure if your intent and in your situation that you're planning to go there, but one of the things that I think we sometimes miss when you look at the percent of students not on track, for example, in reading proficiency or math proficiency, you know, we categorize that, and yet many of these young people are in the same kind of learning situation with one another.
Mm-hmm.
And all may be in the same class. What is it that makes the difference in why one would learn and why one would not? And I don't know how much research there is in it. Now, we tend to talk, you know, what programs work, and most of the things are, you know, whether it's class size, process kinds of things, but I don't know that we really dig down to the point is, what is the instruction that makes a difference?
Mm-hmm. Dr. Ivers.
And it would be elements of that. The assessment, I think, is really important, and I think that's one of the reasons why I hope we will see more widespread acceptance and use of what's called RTI, a response to intervention or response to instruction, mm-hmm. where there's very simple kinds of assessments that determines where what a child is or is not doing in a given area, and then they can change whatever that instructional method or that intervention is. And I think we still have a great need for some identity of what are good interventions or what are good instructional tools that can make the difference. Because if we really do believe that all kids can learn, we say it all the time, mm-hmm. and yet we continue to say, oh, but this child is on free and reduced price lunch. They've got their low income. Those kids can learn. You've just acknowledged it mm-hmm. in yourself. Mm-hmm. You made it to a PhD, and there's others that have done that as well.
Mm-hmm.
And whether the color of your skin or what other the kinds of environmental things, those are areas that we can't control in the education setting. But we really should focus to be sure that what's done in the classroom, that our teachers are equipped to have a variety of tools, because we also know that they all don't learn in the same way. Mm-hmm. So do you intend, or somewhere along the way, could dig into some of the research, what has been done, what needs to be done, mm-hmm. to give further clarity? Because I think it does fall in line with what Senator Hand is asking. You know, are we doing the things that are going to get the best return on the investment we're now making? And I think we have to continue to work to that end rather than just add another layer of programs on top of it, mm-hmm. if we're going to not change what's at the core.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Eilers and then Senator Roebling.
Senator, very complex question, and I'll try to take a stab at it. But the picture that you have painted is one that has really, in a way, mirrored what we have learned about children and learning over the 20th century. We have increasingly learned considerably more each passing year about larger social context, which is the socioeconomics and the racial situation, which is really just very large. And as we keep moving down to with greater specificity, we understand more and more things about the systems in which these students live, social and academic or school settings. And then at the classroom level, we're learning more and more about what's going on between the teacher and the student. And increasingly, we're learning more about cognition and brain and the brain and the brain development. Those are very far removed, of course, from the outside of what a student looks like socioeconomically and racially. And it does come down to cognitive functioning and a variety of things, as well as the inputs. And the inputs are the multiple ways of learning. And the differentiation of instruction, the kinds of tools that a teacher can bring to bear once a teacher has a better diagnostics, really, of where this child is at and their learning style, their learning pace, their learning conditions. We are learning so much more every day about that. The learning is the one thing. The doing is the other. So while we are beginning to appreciate the complexity of educating the human being, it's a complex enterprise, we're at the same time trying to tool up our educators and our providers, our social and academic providers, on how to meet those child's needs where they're at. That does go back to asking questions and reforming the degree-granting institutions, what sorts of tools and what sorts of options are and training options are teachers available are available to them, as well as the professional development field. Is the professional development field keeping up with the things we're learning all the time about how children learn. The other input, of course, are these interventions I'm talking about, and you're right. The interventions happen after the fact. It's after we've learned that Susie or Johnny isn't doing what we need to do. The input is just as important. The input is on setting the student up well, to do well, and taking full advantage of the learning opportunities. You can see that there's this synchronous relationship going on. There's the child and their home and learning conditions and their own multiple functionings. All of us have multiple intelligences that don't map on exactly with what the teacher in the school system can offer. But the closer we get at linking the variations of the student and the variations of the educational tools with greater differentiation and distinction, the better we'll do. But as you may know, if any of you are former teachers, when you are one person faced with 30 different students and you're going to try to differentiate at 30 different levels, it is quite an incredible task. And doing it day in and day out, 5 days a week with very little chance of time. This is by way of acknowledging that education is a complex profession. It is a difficult profession, and educating a young mind is a difficult task. But the more that we can bring together the variety of things that we know are required in engaging a learner and advancing a learner, the better that we'll do by them.
Dr. Eilers, thank you. I we are going to be having another session on testing, because I think these are complicated issues, and with regard to differentiated learning and how can we measure our assessment. But I know a couple other senators still had questions, so I wanted to move along. Thank you. Senator Roebling?
Thank you. I just want to go back quickly to your comment about prenatal care and our low participation rate in that. And I'm puzzled by it, because we have one of the highest numbers of insured people in the country. We're into the 90 percentile for health insurance. All of our public assistance medical programs offer prenatal care. We have the WIC program active. Minnesota Care offers it. I'm wondering, if people have access and they're not using it, what do we do?
Mm-hmm. Senator, it's an interesting question. I don't know why our access rates are so low. I don't know.
Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, thank you. I just want to ask, and I can't remember, who's the expert we had last week? What was his name?
Dr. Lester? No, which one?
Schmidt.
With Kim?
Oh. Yeah, Dr. Schmidt, who I know you're familiar with his work. And going back to Senator Olson's question, I think, what I heard from him, and, maybe I'm oversimplifying, which is what I would prefer to do on this, give me some easy answers. But I got the message from him that the achievement difference between kids in K-12 was more related to the fact that they were in different classrooms. And the kids that were doing well were being offered more rigorous programs. And that was sort of how he explained the achievement gap. And I don't know if you agree with that analysis, or if that's sort of oversimplifying. I mean, it sounded to me like Senator Olson's question was more like, if you have a bunch of kids in one classroom, how come some are doing well and some aren't? And that's an obviously more complex question.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Dr. Eilers.
Senator, what I believe Dr. Schmidt was referring to is ability grouping. Mm-hmm. And a long, controversial history around ability grouping. And I don't know that we have the time or am I prepared to address the pros and cons of ability grouping. But what Dr. Schmidt has also determined through his analysis and how we did move quite considerably in our TIMS scores, especially for fourth grade math from 1995 to 2007, is that, and this is one explanation, I think it's bears mentioning there should be further analysis done. But he said, we've also been trying to teach a lot of things, a mile wide, an inch deep. And there's a lot of interesting things, research coming out of Michigan State University on teaching foundational concepts, 9 important big ideas that are universal, and then teaching the various branches of those things that come off of those 9 big ideas. He's pointed out that in developing state standards, Minnesota has narrowed that universe of the mile wide, and we're holding students to higher, tougher standards, so it's not a mile wide and inch deep. We also don't want to go to an inch wide and a mile deep because we're losing a lot of other educational opportunities there as well. We're still struggling, I would say, in the field of education, knowledge building and cognition on what is the proper breadth and depth of learning. What should be included in what depth and what can be let go of? I'd say here at the beginning of the 21st century, we're right there at that point. How much breadth, how much depth? Obviously, teaching a little bit of everything isn't getting us there. But Minnesota has moved to setting some expectations of students and standards of students. And, of course, the more we hold ourselves to higher standards and support students to get there, and I know we can, we will. And I think the TIMSS data showed that.
Well, Dr. Eilers, thank you very much for being with us today. You've given us wonderful food for thought and sparked a great discussion. Just to review what we'll be doing in our committee over the next couple weeks, next week, Tuesday and Wednesday, February 24th and 25th, we will hear the governor's bill, which is Senate File 836. Members should keep in mind as we listen to that we have been warned that after we hear the forecast, the governor's bill may very well change because, in fact, we have heard Senator Michelle's been talking about, we're all hearing that the deficit will indeed grow beyond what we currently think. So there could be changes to the governor's proposal after hearing the February forecast.
And Madam Chair?
Senator Olson.
And the other element is the understanding of the impact of the stimulus funds, how they can be used. And that could change the direction of his proposal as well.
Yes, Senator Olson, and I don't know whether or not the governor will alter his proposal based on that or whether that will come later.
I think they've said that it wouldn't be now, but it would be as soon as that forecast comes.
Thank you. And then following that, on Thursday, February 26th, next week, we will hear a presentation centered on integration, segregation, and the achievement gap. After we have that overview, then the working group will start to meet on integration aid. The following week, on March 3rd, we will not have committee because that is when the forecast will be presented, and then following that, March 4th and 5th, testing and assessments. And I think we'll continue to explore the discussions that were raised today with regard to testing and assessments. So thank you very much, everyone, for being here and for participating.
Is that on email? Did we all get that list that you just shared?
Senator Olson, I'll make sure that we get that.
That would be good.
Yes.
Thank you.
Committee's adjourned.